Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who discusses the rising civilian death toll in the Yemen war, where 40 children in a bus were recently killed by a U.S.-supported Saudi airstrike. Anti-nuclear activist Mark Colville, who explains how he and his six fellow Plowshares defendants plan to defend themselves against charges they face for their symbolic protest against nuclear weapons at Georgia's King Bay Naval Base. And Andrew Linhart of the Sierra Club, who takes a critical look at the Trump administration's plan to roll back Obama-era auto fuel efficiency and pollution standards. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During his brief tenure as Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson made enemies of two powerful allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The Persian Gulf states were upset over Tillerson's efforts to mediate the Saudi-led blockade against Qatar. The Intercept reports that in the summer of 2017, Saudi Arabia and key Gulf allies faced Tillerson's opposition to their plans to invade Qatar. As CEO of ExxonMobil, Tillerson developed close ties with Qatari officials. As Secretary of State, Tillerson urged King Salman and other top Saudi officials to reduce tensions with Qatar. The invasion plan, revealed by Qatari intelligence agents just weeks before it was set to be carried out, called for Saudi troops to cross the border into Qatar with military support from the UAE. According to a source close to the Emirati royal family and another source who is close to the Saudi royal family, beginning in the fall of 2017, the crown princes of both Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi began lobbying the Trump White House for Tillerson's removal. In recent years, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have worked together to militarily intervene in the region, including deploying troops to Bahrain during the Arab Spring protests in 2011 and launching the brutal war in Yemen. In the weeks after Hurricane Maria decimated Puerto Rico, inmates at the Bayamon Correctional Facility were cut off from water, electricity, and isolated from family members for weeks. The difficulties inflicted on inmates in the Commonwealth's jails spiked after Puerto Rico's unelected Financial Control Board, known as La Junta, imposed broad austerity measures, including severe cuts in public education. Hidden inside the plan was a scheme to transfer one-third of the island's prison population to private jails in the United States mainland. The plan, which supporters claim will save $400 million, faces strong opposition from inmates and prison reformers. William Ramirez of the American Civil Liberties Union chapter in Puerto Rico blasted the corrections scheme as government-sponsored human trafficking, being undertaken in the name of profit since inmates as wards of the state cannot freely provide consent for their transfer. For over 20 years, Puerto Rican officials have tried and failed to move inmates to U.S. prisons. 500 Puerto Rican prisoners were transferred to Minnesota in 1993, but were returned 2 years later after complaints about substandard conditions at the jail. 480 of the island's prisoners were moved to Oklahoma in 2012, but that program was scuttled a year later after Puerto Rican inmates rioted at the facility. Billionaire Steve Cohen's hedge fund company, SAC Capital, pled guilty to insider trading charges in 2013 and paid $1.8 billion in penalties. But Cohen, who eluded criminal charges himself, now runs a private fund with $11 billion in assets. After his son served in Afghanistan, he's taken an interest in veterans' healthcare issues, specifically post-traumatic stress disorder. His nonprofit, Cohen Veterans Network, has won support from congressional Republicans who want to promote the privatization of veterans' health care as an alternative to the federally operated Veterans Administration. ProPublica reports that veterans' clinics run by Cohen's network have a mixed record, including accusations of cherry-picking patients and mismanagement. Controversy surrounded Cohen's first clinic at New York University over questions raised about who controlled patent rights to medical research that Cohen financed. More recently, Cohen backed an aggressive lobbying campaign to secure government reimbursements for his veterans' clinics, which were initially advertised as free to patients. Cohen, who contributed $1 million to Trump's inauguration fund and another $1 million to the House Republican super PAC in April 2017, succeeded in bypassing congressional opposition when he eventually was approved to receive reimbursements from the VA. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the latest carnage witnessed in Yemen's ongoing brutal war, 51 civilians were killed, 40 of them children, when on August 9th, a Saudi airstrike targeted a bus carrying young students who were on a school recreational field trip in the northern province of Sada'a. While Saudi officials claim they never deliberately target civilians, human rights groups accuse the Saudi-led military coalition of indiscriminately bombing schools, hospitals, markets, and residential neighborhoods. During the course of the war, the U.S. has provided the Saudi military coalition, comprised of 9 Middle Eastern and African nations, with intelligence, logistics, and air refueling support. Local journalists at the scene of the school bus bombing report that they found fragments of a U.S.-made Mark 82 bomb used in the attack, which is jointly manufactured by Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics. Saudi Arabia and its allies, who buy billions of dollars worth of weapons from the U.S., Britain, and France, has waged a campaign against Yemen's Houthi rebels since early 2015. The coalition says it's fighting to counter the regional influence of the Houthis' ally, Iran. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who discusses the rising civilian death toll in Yemen and the effort by some members of the U.S. House of Representatives to end U.S. involvement in Yemen's war that has killed as many as 50,000 and displaced more than 3 million.
Well, the school bus was carrying children on their field trip, and one little boy on the bus had actually taken footage of the kids, you know, doing what kids do on a bus. They're giggling and kind of moving around and getting a chance to talk with each other. And now that little boy who filmed it was killed, but his cell phone was retrieved, and CNN showed that video footage. They were kids who were looking forward for days to this holiday that they were going to get to take, going to a grassy area for a picnic following the summer school they'd been in, which was for religious studies. The Saudis initially said, no, there were no children on that bus. And now they've said, well, we'll do an investigation. But it seems to me highly inadequate to say, oh, okay, the Saudis will investigate this situation, because already the Saudi king has issued a pardon for any Saudi military person's activities that might in any way be seen to be wrongdoing. He's just absolved them all in advance. We've found that in the past, when the Saudis targeted and hit a Doctors Without Borders hospital, they said, well, we'll ask our American counterparts for better guidance. Well, the United States had just hit 3 weeks earlier a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan, so that might have been even a bit tongue-in-cheek. And, you know, at this point, trying to understand the extent of suffering the Saudis are causing, you know, I think certainly the parents and the relatives and friends of those children and the traumatized survivors of the killing and bloodshed when the bus was hit is front and center in our minds. But in June of this past summer, the Doctors Without Borders had just finished completing a center for treatment of cholera, and they're anticipating a third epidemic wave of cholera, and the Saudis bombed that.
There was a very disturbing news report that emerged recently that talked about the Saudi-led coalition battling Houthi rebels in Yemen, secured secret deals with al-Qaeda in Yemen, and recruited hundreds of the group's fighters to assist them in their battle against the Houthis. What can you tell us about this deal-making that's going on between the Saudi-led coalition and these terrorist groups?
Well, it seems like the Saudi-led coalition wanted to say, oh, yes, we've rooted all of these al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula fighters. But then it turned out that was hardly the case. They paid some of the commanders really handsome sums of money, and they gave safe passage to convoys of these fighters who were moving out. And they, at one place, there was even a farewell dinner for them. So, you know, I think the United States perhaps isn't going to want it to be well known that its supposed partners in fighting the war on terror are actually in some ways linked up with the people that are supposedly the terrorists, and that they then say, well, you know, if you want, you can come and work for us. How would that be? And then recruit them into their armed services. I mean, you don't find very many Saudi military people on the ground in Yemen doing the fighting. They've bought people over from amongst the Janjaweed fighters in South Sudan. They've bought people that are desperate from other African countries in to do the fighting, and now they're trying to recruit al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula former fighters.
Earlier this year, members of the House of Representatives, bipartisan group of congresspeople, got together and put forward some measures that would put them on record as being opposed to the U.S. involvement in the Yemen war. What is the current status of efforts to continue opposition to what the Trump administration is doing in aiding the Saudi coalition in Yemen?
Well, Representative Ro Khanna in California and Representative Barbara Lee, I'm hoping, will press forward with one piece of legislation, House Resolution 81, which is still on the books. It would be possible to get more co-sponsors. But, you know, that Resolution 81 could have gone forward for a vote, but instead the Democratic whip, Steny Hoyer, decided that he would put forth a different resolution, which was a non-binding resolution, and it condemned the Saudi war. But because it was non-binding, it didn't mean anything. You know, it was just like if you or I made a statement. And so I think there's a high reluctance to offend the Saudi prince. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman came to the United States. He was treated like royalty. He was met with by every past president of the United States who's alive today. Oprah Winfrey met with him. Heads of showbiz met with him. He went all around the United States making public relations appearances. And then Speaker of the House Paul Ryan organized a delegation to go over to Saudi Arabia, and people shook hands with the Crown Prince, and President Trump's first international trip was to Saudi Arabia. So I think, you know, the Saudi royalty that haven't been locked up by their brother, it's an interesting story. He rounded up his cousins and some of his own brothers and kind of kept them at the Ritz-Carlton until they agreed to turn over vast parts of their fortunes, because I think he is very worried about how he's going to pay for this war that costs $200 million a day.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Learn more about the war in Yemen and U.S. involvement in the conflict by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 4th, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., seven Catholic activists carried out the 100th Plowshares protest action against nuclear weapons, this time at the Kings Bay Naval Station in Georgia, the largest nuclear submarine base in the world. Carrying hammers and bottles of their own blood, the seven symbolically attempted to convert the submarines that carry nuclear weapons. Plowshares actions take their name from the biblical imperative to beat swords into plowshares, and activists focus on nonviolent direct actions against nuclear weapons. After spending a few months in jail, four of the Kings Bay Plowshares participants were bailed out to address personal issues and to organize support for their upcoming trial. Mark Colville, who along with his wife, Luz, has run the Amistad Catholic Worker House in New Haven, Connecticut for the past 25 years, served more than a year in prison in the late 1990s for another Plowshares action. He's one of three Plowshares activists who remain in prison. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Colville by phone in jail. After describing prison conditions, no activities or time outdoors and very little opportunity for exercise, he talked about the Plowshares legal case and the arguments their lawyers will be bringing to trial.
There's a preliminary hearing. It's called a motions hearing, and both sides in the case present written motions to the court ahead of time, and the hearing is an opportunity to argue those motions. Sort of the main motion that we had filed was a motion to dismiss the charges. Our argument is based on six reasons why the charges should be dismissed. I'll quickly give you those. One is that nuclear weapons are illegal under U.S. law. Secondly, nuclear weapons are illegal under U.S. and international law. Number three, therefore, the property that is in question that we're accused of damaging is not entitled to protection under the law. Fourth, there's a religious freedom argument, which is kind of interesting, which I can get into. But basically, our necessity to go on the base is rooted in our religious faith. All seven of us are actually Roman Catholics, so we're prepared to make an argument that what we did at Kings Bay was actually a requirement of our faith practice. Then number five was that the prosecutor, the government, is engaged in selective and vindictive prosecution, which is related to the last point, which is that we've been charged with the same offense in more than one count. So actually the charges that we're under are three felonies and a misdemeanor, the misdemeanor being trespass. And the felonies are destruction of government property, depredation of government property, and conspiracy. So basically the arguments we made are kind of interesting. First of all, we're trying to make the point that nuclear weapons are illegal, and really this is the whole point of, large part, it's the point of Plowshares' actions, is that there has been no way to get nuclear weapons judged in a court, and we've tried many other ways. And what we find in the federal courts is that clearly the laws are in place, both constitutionally, domestic law as well as international law. Clearly the laws are there that make it clear that nuclear weapons are illegal. The problem is that the way the law is applied in the federal courts, the application of the law essentially puts nuclear weapons beyond the reach of law. Okay? So not only has nobody in 73 years, not only has nobody ever voted for a nuclear weapon or been able to approve or disapprove of one, but their legality has never been really at all challenged in a court of law. And in fact, Plowshares' cases are mostly designed to try to change that. And in fact, it's kind of a sad commentary that citizens have to put themselves at such risk, both in terms of physical harm and then of course lengthy jail time, just to change that reality that they've managed to place nuclear weapons beyond the reach of law. So we're trying to argue that our action was necessary based on that. The religious freedom thing is actually, it's kind of ironic that we're actually making a new argument here based on recent development, something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which has really gotten some teeth in the past few years, with Trump being president and even before that. But people may recall that there was a case out in Colorado about so-called Christians refusing to bake a cake for a gay wedding. And that, I guess, went all the way to the Supreme Court. Their argument was based on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And basically, the argument is that, or the law says that in cases where the government needs to restrain people who are practicing their religion, that they must do so in the least intrusive way available. And so part of our argument in terms of dismissal was that we didn't need to be charged with three felonies and a misdemeanor for what we did. There are much less restrictive ways of limiting our actions.
That was Mark Colville, one of the Kings Bay Plowshares seven Catholic activists who entered the Kings Bay Naval Station to call for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Supporters are organizing a peace walk from the city of Savannah to Kings Bay, September 3rd through the 14th. For more information on the Kings Bay Plowshares action, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 2nd, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency, along with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, announced their plan to repeal regulations that require automakers that sell cars and light trucks in the U.S. to steadily increase fuel efficiency and reduce pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. Under the Obama administration, automakers were required to nearly double the fuel efficiency of passenger vehicles to an average of 54 miles per gallon by 2025. Instead, the Transportation Department will freeze the standard at the 2021 level to an average 37 miles per gallon. The Trump EPA also says it's revoking the Clean Air Act waiver, which authorizes the state of California to set its own more demanding air quality and fuel efficiency standards. If the California waiver is revoked, California, 13 other states in the District of Columbia, would be forced to follow lower federal standards. In response to the Trump move, 17 states in the District of Columbia have already filed a lawsuit asking a federal court to block Trump's rules change. They're challenging the rollback of standards as arbitrary and without evidence justifying their action. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Linhart, Sierra Club Associate Director for Legislative and Administrative Advocacy, who discusses his group's response to the Trump attempt to weaken fuel efficiency and pollution standards.
So one thing I want to emphasize is it's more than just fuel efficiency standards. So the program is actually made up of both the fuel efficiency standards side, which most people are familiar with, but EPA more directly regulates greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles. And that's also what California regulates. So they are focused on reducing those harmful climate pollution, you know, mostly coming in the form of carbon dioxide from vehicle tailpipes. But California and EPA focus on that side, and the Department of Transportation focuses on the fuel efficiency. So it's a little different, but the program's goal are basically the same thing, which is to get more mileage out of every tank of gas that people fill up with. And unfortunately, the Trump administration wants to roll back this whole program. So freezing the standards at the 2020 numbers and getting rid of essentially 6 years of additions. So essentially, it's going to cost people more money on every tank of gas while adding more pollution to the air. So it's really unfortunate, you know, especially with the timing as we're seeing the impacts of climate change across the country. And speaking of California with that, you know, the devastating fires that those people have been dealing with out there, California, it's not just California's program. There are 12 states plus the District of Columbia that also follow California's emissions program. So it's more like, I believe the number is closer to 120 or so million people that follow California's authority on this. So President Trump and the folks at EPA and DOT are really going after a big chunk of the American population.
Andrew, the Trump administration has offered up a very strange rationale for their move here to roll back fuel efficiency standards and greenhouse gas emission standards. And that is, they're claiming that lowering these standards will save lives. They say that people who drive fuel-efficient cars drive more, therefore there'll be more accidents. They also talk about fuel efficiency standards causing automobiles and trucks to be more expensive. Therefore, people can't buy the newest model of cars and won't benefit from the standard improved safety apparatus in these cars. What do you make of this rationale?
Well, you know, on its face, it's kind of hard to even believe. And we are still digging through all the documents to get to how they figured this out. But it's fairly clear that none of those arguments actually hold up in the real world. The idea that people are driving more and therefore getting into more accidents, I think, is kind of belied by DOT's own stats on highway deaths, which unfortunately have been up in whole numbers, but I believe as a percentage of the vehicle miles traveled are still relatively low. I think we can all attest that distracted driving seems to be a bigger cause of accidents these days than anything else. Making vehicles more expensive, even if the vehicle is increased a little bit in price, that is pretty much dwarfed by the savings on the increased fuel efficiency that you get. Estimates put it between, somewhere between $12,000 and $2,000, depending on the price of gas and the type of vehicle. But all vehicles are getting more efficient. So, you know, even folks that need to drive trucks for work or need the space for families versus folks driving smaller, even more fuel efficient vehicles, all classes of vehicles increase in their fuel efficiency, which really saves everyone money and really reduces emissions. So it's really kind of hard to buy into the argument.
Andrew, I wanted to ask you about effective challenges to what's underway now with the Trump administration by way of these fuel efficiency standards, greenhouse gas emission standards. What is being done to challenge what the Trump administration is doing here?
Sure. There will soon be an open public comment period, so we encourage everyone to take advantage of that. You can find that on regulations.gov and then also on the EPA and DOT websites. Anyone can comment, and that will be taken into account from the agencies when they do the final rule. There will also be three public hearings. And of course, there's going to be legal options that will go on with this. I believe it was 18 state attorneys general announced their intent to fight this rollback if this is what the final rule looks like. And you can expect a wide range of organizations like Sierra Club and many of our allies to also be involved in those lawsuits. But it's full-throated defense of these rules. The Trump administration really is going to have to make quite an argument to win this, we think. These rules are very popular in the public sphere, and they're also well-grounded in the law.
That was Andrew Linhart, Sierra Club Associate Director for Legislative and Administrative Advocacy. Learn more about groups opposing the Trump administration's rollback of auto fuel efficiency and pollution standards by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, and more than 60 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.